It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last week, Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison wrote an article in the Capital Times. In the article, he says, despite Madison's identity as a liberal or progressive place, Wisconsin's capital fails its African-American community in numerous ways.
Today, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy also released a report on the, quote, vast chasm separating Wisconsin's African-American and white economic outcomes. It's across the state, noting that Wisconsin ranks second in the nation for economic disparity between blacks and whites. We've invited Reverend Alex G. to join us to discuss the situation that he's witnessed in Madison. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure being here.
Now, why did you write the article in the first place? It almost feels like, you know, with they say with 12-step programs, you have to know you have a problem to get started. Was that sort of part of what you were doing in writing this article?
Well, I think so. I've noticed a few things that if you're not indigenous to Madison, you're not really allowed to speak out against Madison. And if you're from Madison and you're doing fairly well, it's difficult to speak out because people ask, well, how can you complain? You're living a good life and you benefit from this community. And so I've straddled the fence for a number of years, but after personal experiences, just mounting up over the years, I just decided that if I don't lend my voice as a person who is indigenous to this community, then the subject matter of profiling, of mass incarceration, et cetera, would have little or no credibility. So I wrote it so that I would not betray my South Madison community where I grew up and where I know on a daily basis. People experience the things that I do.
And so one of the points you make is that even though Madison's seen as sort of a progressive and open place, it's not as welcoming and open to African Americans in a lot of ways.
Exactly. And I tried to balance the article by showing that I'm very proud to be Madisonian, that my family's been here for 45 years. And what I really said is I want the Madisonian atmosphere that my family felt in 1970, where we weren't stigmatized by being from the west side of Chicago. We weren't viewed with suspicion that we were here for better welfare benefits or to bring crime or to bring down the graduation or the performance of students of color. I felt that the community was very affirming. My mom received 2 degrees from the University of Wisconsin, and she never went to high school. And she was on the dean's list in grad school, and she sent both my sister, Laleda, and I to the university, and we both graduated. But it seems like things have changed over the years, that we've become hoarders and we're afraid that outsiders are coming to take our city away from us. And I feel that it's much different than it was when I was a kid and the total minority population was probably less than 1%. Hmm. So I wrote it to help Madison remember its roots and not live in its rearview mirror by remembering, you know, the days of the protests over the Vietnam War or sitting in for the Black Student Union or the Black Studies program. I think we if we're not careful, we live so much in our rearview mirror that we think we have no responsibility to make things fair today. And I just wrote that because I wanted to help the community to have a healthy checkup.
Now, you mentioned the difference between the 1970s and now. That actually was something that was pointed out in the report that was done by the Center for Wisconsin Strategy, too, where they said that things are much different in Wisconsin now than they were in the 1970s. You kind of touched on that, but what do you think some of the issues are? Do you think it is sort of this don't come into Wisconsin kind of thing going on? Or
I think that that's part of it. I remember when there was some talk in the mid-90s about welfare reform. The word on the street, the discussion was that we were too attractive to outside individuals who were moving here because we were paying our poor people so well that that they were coming to Wisconsin so that they could make it big and become middle class. I'm being facetious. And so, but I feel that the numbers were so small in the 70s, it wasn't perceived as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
We were still a novelty. I could go 3 days without seeing someone who looked like me. I've only had 2 African-American teachers from second grade through my graduation from high school. However, there was an openness even to the kids who attended Leopold Elementary School but lived on farms in Fitchburg. There was still an openness and acceptance. I feel something shifted. It's more combative. It just feels different, and it feels like everyone's vying for the same piece of pie. Therefore, they're being suspicious. And not as welcoming to the new kids on the block.
So do you think some of that has to do with political discussions that have happened in the state, or do you think there's more to it than that?
I think that the political discussions are part of it, but I think it just goes way back. I think when the populations began to increase and the demographics changed, and it became apparent that Madison's different. I noticed from 1980 to 1990, the African-American population in Madison doubled. Well, no one saw that coming. And then when you have increased numbers, you have increased demand. So you're wondering, well, where are the African-American police officers and librarians and mail carriers and administrators in schools? And so I suppose the broader community thought it's never been a problem up till now. Our teachers have taught everyone. So now you want inclusive curriculum and you want Black history and you want Black teachers teaching Black history. And I think just when the African-American community was being able to use the homeowners' towels, the city put the guest towels back out. And so there was a sense that you're not really from here. And when you're not from a place, you're not as committed to it. I mean, people treat home a lot differently than they treat hotel rooms.
And to illustrate your point, in the article, you talked about how these things affect you on a regular basis, including some examples of racial profiling that you experience. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I talked about two examples of being pulled over by the police in the 90s. It was called the Blue Blanket. And I went to tell my part-time receptionist that she didn't have to come to work. She was sick. And I was pulled over because the officer asked why I did not go into her house. And I said, well, she's my employee. I'm a male. I'm married. I'm not going to do that. And I just told her she didn't. And I didn't want to catch what she had. And he said, well, it looked like you were setting up for a drug deal and your actions fit the profile of a drug dealer. And I had a black suit on. I was going to take pictures for our church. And that was two blocks from my church. My church was on Badger Road. And this was right at the Park Bank parking lot in broad daylight. It was embarrassing. The second time, I mentioned just a few years ago, I was meeting my associate, who's a white gentleman, and he was in our parking lot waiting for us. We have a standing Saturday evening meeting, and he was waiting. And the police pulled me over and said they were looking for someone in a red car. My car's black, and started asking me why was I there and who I was. And so I started showing ID. My white colleague, who was sitting there in his car, got out, walked over to the police, which I, as an African-American male, would never do, not out of fear of being shot by Madison police. That's not my concern, but being embarrassed or yelled at. Or I just learned you don't do that. When the police pull you over, you put your hands at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel and you answer the questions nicely. He started, engaging in small talk, and they asked him if I was who I said I was. Not once did they ask him why he was there or who he was or if they could see ID, but yet they wanted him to corroborate my identity without even seeing his identity. And so in the story, I mentioned that when my church was broken into in that same parking lot, I described myself to the 911, to the dispatch, just because I didn't want any confusion. I didn't want them to come in after calling about a break-in and thinking that I might be the assailant. So I described my sweater, my jeans, the color, make a mark on my collar of my car, just because I didn't want the frustration and the professional embarrassment of someone coming over asking me who I was and what I was doing there while a guy was downstairs wrecking my church.
Mm, wow. It sounds like those experiences could make you a little grumpy.
Well, they do. You know what's interesting? And this is what I try to help people to understand. Although I may insinuate that there is some profiling, and I'm sorry, let me back up. I think there's definitely some profiling, whether or not that's solely on race. I'm sure that that's a huge part of it. I never was able to get the officer to say, yes, I pulled you over because you're black. So there's never any proof. That's what I think I'm trying to say. But when the next time that incident happens, it awakens all of the other experiences. So I can put it behind me because you have to be able to function and to be a team member and to not walk around totally violent. So I forget about it until the very next time it happens, and then it all comes back. And I think when I called the police and described myself, and that was just a few months ago, it brought back the other experiences. And I think at that point, I started writing the article in my head.
So the article has gotten a lot of response from
people. It's gotten a lot of response. I mean, writing is not new to me, but I don't really write for newspapers. I mean, I've written a few books, and so it's interesting. You write a book and it's not in print for another year. It's very interesting to write something and it's on the front cover the next week. Cap Times called me over the weekend and told me that it was the top read story. It has more than 4,000 shares. So not hits, but 4,000 shares. And it is by far the leading read article last month. Well, that's flooring me, but I'm receiving all kinds of calls. Strangers are stopping me and introducing themselves to me. And people want to help. People are saying, we hear you. We believe it. What do we do? What can we do to be very helpful? So I have to say, we want to see the action, but the outpouring, the response makes me really proud to be a part of this community.
Wow. Now, you've been a pastor in this area for how long?
Oh, about 28, 30 years.
Now, how come you never brought this up earlier? You said, what sort of motivated you now to do this?
Oh, I talk about it. So yeah. I've written about it. I write about it in the Madison Times. So I've written about it.
Yeah.
What really push buttons for me. And again, this is when I was at Downtown Rotary giving a talk about mass incarceration. And this isn't meant to be a reflection or a poor reflection on Rotary. It's just where I was when things clicked and when the straw broke the camel's back.
Right, right.
And when this woman kept pushing me and congratulating me on not being angry and then started comparing me to other African-American leaders who are my colleagues and friends, I just said, okay, now I'm benign and I'm safe. And then now you want to put a wedge between me and my colleague. And this is the thanks I get for coming and saying what I'm saying. And everyone in that room didn't do that. There was just this one particular woman. But when she did it, I said, all right, I'm going public. And so I called my friend Phil Haslinger, who I knew was a writer. He's a pastor now. He introduced me to Paul Fanland. And I told him the story. And Paul was listening with being cordial. I mean, Paul's a nice guy. I don't know him well. But when I told the part about calling 911 and describing myself, he dropped his head, and when he raised it, he said, I never think of describing myself when I call 911. I want you to write me 3,000 words. I want to put this on the front cover. He just laid everything out. Because I think at that point he realized I wasn't walking around saying, my food is cold because I'm black. You know, my car gets ticketed because I'm black. It's colder in my house because it's black. I think he realized, all right, whether or not he had to do that, the fact that this man who has served this community from everything as a paper boy to an assistant to David Ward when he was chancellor years ago to a pastor, that if he has to think about describing himself before dialing 911, which is his right as a taxpayer, that's important enough to me that he thinks he has to do it. And Paul said, I want you to write that. So I think it came because of a culmination of things. But I think just trying to prove to someone that I wasn't angry revealed just how angry I was. And I think that was the proverbial straw that broke that camel's back.
Wow. I mean, there was another thing that jumped out in the piece you wrote where somebody said, well, you do have a nice car, you know.
Yes. And I think and I said at which point I realized that not only was I angry, I was hurt and disillusioned.
Yeah.
Because that was just
so that would
sort
make
of
somebody,
the apex of
somebody think you're a drug dealer because
right.
you have a nice
like,
car.
Like what else would they think, Alex? I'm thinking, wow, my mom moved me here as a single mom going through a divorce and paid for my college tuition. I didn't have any student loans. I lived at home. She paid for my college tuition so I could get a job. My wife and I had no children. I was a University of Wisconsin employee, as was my wife. I could afford a $10,000 car, which is, I mean, I say that joke. That's how much it cost. It was a you know, Chevy Toyota. It was a Nova.
Right.
Yet my friend thought, well, that was a pretty nice, he thought you're driving a pretty nice car. So the guy's just doing his job. Cut him some slack. And it was very sincere. We're friends to this day. That wasn't a mean email or back in those days a fax or a letter.
Right.
He was just trying to help me to make sense of it. It was his way of saying, Alex, it wasn't about race. It wasn't because he was a bad guy. He's protecting the community because people who look like you commit drunk crimes, particularly those with nice cars. And I'm thinking, this is Madison. We probably have more blacks who have degrees than who are drug dealers.
So you've gotten people's attention. And what's next?
Yes.
What's the next thing? What are you going to do next?
Well, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I saw this coming. I mean, you know, I run a nonprofit, an urban leadership development organization. I pastor a church. I'm doing hospital visits. I'm traveling. I'm a speaker. I did not know that there was going to be this kind of response. I thought it would be on the front cover. You'd be the flavor of the day, and then it'll go away, and then I'll tuck it away in an album and show my grandchildren one day. But now I'm realizing I'll probably have to cut my vacation short, which is all right. I mean, sometimes an opportunity calls you. And I want to spend some time meeting with political leaders. I've had one reach out to me. The county executive called me and said he'd like to talk. I like to meet with other elected officials just to say, hey, I have my point of view and I've got some emotion behind this, but I'm part of this community and I want to help to bring solutions. I want to bring people to the table who are not normally to the table. I want to listen to disenfranchised folks and hear their story. But I'm also spending time listening to school teachers and concern. Most of the emails I'm getting are from white Madisonians who are saying, we want to do something. How do we help? How do we support? So I want to hear their voices as well as help to network them in places already established programs and organizations that they can plug into. So I think the next step is really doing a little bit more homework, because this is catching me off guard a bit. But putting together planning teams and having some community events. And I received a call from Cap Times today, and they want to actually host the community forum where I want to, along with community leaders — this is not the Alex G Show — with community leaders, make some recommendations for some very solid next steps. We don't want to fall into the typical Madisonian trap of just having other discussions and white papers and coalitions. We want to recommend probably a half dozen doable things that we can take on to the next year, year and a half. So we could say we haven't fixed everything, but we've done something other than talk. And so in the next several weeks to the next month, I want to present some of those things once I've had a chance to really go deeper and have more talks with my cabinet of friends and associates.
Well, Reverend G, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the interview.
Alex G is a pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church. And thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Still ahead, our guest says 2013 was the greatest year in gay rights history. He'll explain why.
First, many of us are tempted by Christmas cookies and other sweet treats this time of year, but our next guest says if you want a health alternative, nuts are where it's at.
Laura Isaacson is a registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville, and she's here to give tips on turning nuts into a delicious daytime snack. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So it wasn't very long ago that nuts were thought of as a bad thing, and you weren't supposed to eat too many of them, but it seems like things have turned around, huh?
Well, nuts are full of monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats. So those are the healthy fats that are actually good for your heart, and they help to lower your LDL cholesterol, which is your bad cholesterol. So actually including nuts in your diet is good for your heart.
What about the fat? Do we have to worry about the fat in nuts? That's always what you hear sometimes when I say to people, but nuts are healthy, as I'm scarfing down nuts. And they say,
right,
but they're high in fat.
They are high in fat, but the types of fat that are in nuts are more healthy for you than saturated fats, which are the types of fats in animal products. So it's important to include nuts, but because they are high in fat, they're really high in calories as well. So just be mindful of the portion that you're eating. And an appropriate portion of nuts is 1.5 ounces, which is about a handful. So if you are going to have some nuts, just make sure that you eat about a handful and not much more than that.
See, that's the problem that I have. it's impossible for me to eat a handful of nuts. So, I mean, is that one of the things that's kind of edgy about nuts in general, is that they may be good for you, but people are more inclined to just eat them like crazy?
Right. So what you're going to want to do, rather than just eating nuts out of a big bag or a can of nuts, you should pre-portion them out, maybe into a snack-sized baggie, so that you aren't tempted to eat more than the handful or 1.5 ounces. And so that's a really good idea for a snack. If you just bring along a little baggie of nuts and have that for an afternoon snack, that would be a good way to include nuts without eating too many of them.
In terms of which nuts, you know, you get the most nutritional bang for your buck, which nuts are the healthiest?
Well, all nuts are good for you. Walnuts are important to include in your diet because they contain omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory and also really good for your heart. So walnuts are really good, but probably some of the other healthy nuts would include almonds, hazelnuts, peanuts, pecans, pine nuts, pistachios, and then, of course, walnuts.
Now, this time of year, people put weird things on nuts. They put, like, you know, sugar coatings and stuff like that. Does that have a negative impact on whether nuts are good for you or not?
Absolutely. So when you're choosing nuts, make sure that they aren't covered with chocolate, sugar, salt. All of those types of things are going to make them a little bit more unhealthy for you.
But is it still better than eating, you know, a Christmas cookie if you're eating a chocolate-covered nut?
Probably, yes. In the whole scheme of things, that would probably be better. But if you were doing some baking, for example, and you were making some cookies with maybe some chocolate chips or something else like that in them, you could substitute some of the chocolate for nuts to make them a little bit healthier. And you can add in nuts if you're baking bread or doing any other baked goods this time of year. That would be a good addition to make it a little bit healthier.
So one thing about nuts is, I mean, because they have – they have a lot of fiber in them, right?
That's correct.
So is it possible that could fill you up a little bit more if you're a little slower and you're not eating? I mean, is that part of the reason why people could wind up being healthier when they eat nuts?
Right. So we want to include fiber in our diet. Fiber is very healthy for us, for our digestive tracts. If you're trying to lose weight, which most people this time of year are trying to lose a little bit of weight, especially around the new year, fiber helps you to stay full, and fiber also helps to reduce cholesterol. So all foods that are high in fiber are important to include in your diet, and then nuts are a really great source of fiber, so that's another great benefit in addition to the healthy fats. And then another thing I haven't mentioned about nuts is that they are an excellent source of protein.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but okay. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Laura Isaacson, registered dietitian with Upland Hills Health in Dodgeville, talking about the virtues of nuts.
If you have your favorite nut recipe or some convenient snack ideas, you can post them on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out why some say 2013 was the greatest year yet in the entire history of the gay rights movement. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court extended the rights of same-sex couples. President Barack Obama essentially doubled the number of openly gay federal judges and ambassadors.
Besides that, Jason Collins from NBA's Washington Wizards was one of the first professional athletes in major sports to come out, not to mention the fact that several states legalized same-sex marriage. Some are saying 2013 was a banner year for gay rights.
And our next guest agrees with that. Eric Marcus joins us now to talk about the big year for gay rights. He's a journalist and the author of Making Gay History, the Half-Century Fight for Lesbian and Gay Equal Rights. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be with you, Veronica, and I'm so glad there's no snow where I am.
rub it in. Where are you?
I'm in New York City. It was 71 degrees yesterday.
What?
Yeah, 71 balmy degrees. Yes,
oh, my gosh. Insane. Well, all right. I can't dwell too long on that. I'll just get
Sorry.
Bitter.
Sorry.
So let's talk about gay rights this year, 2013. It's been a remarkable year. What happened this year?
It has been the most breathtaking year, and I think that just the events of the last few days suggest the range of what's happened. First, Utah, a judge threw out the ban on marriage between two people of the same sex in Utah. So now gay and lesbian couples are lining up to get married in Utah, of all places. And then halfway around the world in Uganda, the parliament voted to criminalize sexual acts between people of the same sex. So it feels very bipolar at the moment. But here in the U.S., it's all been positive. We started the year with the president's incredible speech at his inauguration and at the State of the Union address, all pro-gay. And the president spoke in ways that I could never have imagined any president would ever speak about gay people.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because that is one of the things that made 2013 what it was to gay rights. President Obama was front and center. He likened the fight for gay rights to Selma, Alabama, and he used the word "we" to indicate that this was, you know, something that included him and the fight for all people involved in this. What did President Obama mean to gay rights this year?
Oh, God. That's a good question. This president has been so beyond extraordinary, especially in comparison to previous presidents, in terms of his complete embracing of gay rights as a national issue, as a national imperative, has made it very much his own. And he's not just talked about it, he's actually made changes. Defense of marriage, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Defense of Marriage Act is gone. As you mentioned, there are lots of people, gay people, serving in his administration. But the fact that the President of the United States has spoken so publicly and openly and supportively of these issues has enormous symbolic value in terms of changing people's attitudes. People can say the President of the United States supports these issues. If I may, I just want to go back in history a little bit to the late 80s, when we considered it an extraordinary moment when, in response to a letter from a parent, Barbara Bush, then the First Lady, wrote a supportive note saying that, that parents should embrace their gay children. That wound up going out on the Associated Press. It was national news. It was a huge deal, and that was simply an expression of support by the First Lady, not the President. That's only the late 80s, and look where we are now.
Oh, that's 20 years. So that, I guess that makes me wonder, you know, you get the sense that there is this momentum right now, that things are rolling forward quickly. Would you agree with that, that there has been some sort of turning point and now it's sort of a boulder rolling down a hill?
Yes. Yes, we've reached the turning point. I think of it, the visual that I think of is if you take a sink full of water and you float a bowl in the water and you slowly push down on the bowl and then suddenly the water pours in over the top, slowly, and then it fills the bowl and the bowl sinks. We've reached that moment. What's happened is so many people now know gay people, because gay people have come out in huge numbers, that you can't demonize us in the way that you once could. So we've gone from a time when you could simply say that your anti-gay views were a matter of opinion to a point in history now where those anti-gay views are increasingly on the fringe, and people who express those views publicly are ostracized. And we've seen that happen. That's another example of what's gone on in recent times. It's not called Duck Soup. Well, please save me from myself. What is the name of that television show?
Duck Soup. I don't know.
It's the popular reality show about the family that produces
Duck
Call.
Duck Dynasty.
Thank you. And the patriarch of the family has now been banished from the show for X number of shows because he said some pretty crazy things about gay people. But the crazy things he said in the past were not considered so crazy. So that's one big way in which things have changed.
And we mentioned the momentum that has picked up, especially in this last year, and President Obama's role in it. Do you think that the president wanted to be a standard bearer, be out at the front of this, or did he just want to be on the boat when it left?
I thought that he actually went a little farther than I would have advised him. When there was discussion before the election last year about whether or not the president was going to publicly advocate support for same-sex marriage, if he had asked me, and he didn't call, if he had asked me, I would have said, that's too dangerous. Don't do it. It's not worth the risk. I'm gay. I've been writing about these issues for years. I'm a big supporter of gay rights, obviously. But I thought it was too risky for the president. I felt that public opinion hadn't moved quite far enough and that it would cost him in the election. But what do I know? It turns out it didn't cost him in the election. It made a difference certainly among young voters. It swayed African-American voters to support this issue in greater numbers. So I think that we can't expect the president or any politician to go that far out ahead of public opinion. But I thought he took a very bold step by announcing his public support before the election last year. And one has to give him a lot of credit for that.
Now, you have agreed that this is the greatest year for gay rights. On the other hand, there are still, I think it's 2/3 of Republicans who say that they are against same-sex marriage, for instance, and is facing shaky support in the House, even though it was passed by the Senate. This is this anti-discrimination law.
It's national anti-discrimination legislation. Yeah.
Right. So, I don't know, is it possible that the celebration right now is being overblown and there's still some pretty big hurdles out there to get over?
I think that we can celebrate and celebrate with enthusiasm and also acknowledge the fact that there's a long way to go and that for many, many gay Americans, it is still a tough life to live where they live. You know, where I live in New York City, it's just fine. But even in my neighborhood in New York, which is very gay-friendly, in fact, I never even think of the fact I'm gay. I'm just a regular person who lives in Chelsea. There are people who get beat up for being gay. And there are kids I hear from routinely in emails who are in terrible straits because they're so afraid of how their families will deal with them if they find out they're gay. I'm working with a young man now on his autobiography, Robbie Rogers. He's a soccer player, the first and only openly gay man to play in one of the top five U.S. professional sports. He came out before Jason Collins and plays for the L.A. Galaxy. He lived in the closet for his entire life until a year ago. He's now 26 years old. And the fact that there are lots of people who still live that way, including many gay men and gay women who are in heterosexual marriages, suggests that we have a lot of work to do. But I don't think there's anything wrong with taking a moment to say 2013 was incredible. We have so much to celebrate and be thankful for, and there are many people we need to thank, including our straight allies and the president, who is a straight ally, But we have a lot of work to do. We've always had a lot of work to do.
Now, it's been suggested that part of the reason this was such a big year for gay rights was that the issue had been reframed a little bit from, you know, finger-pointing and maybe shaming to maybe focus more on families and compassion and caring. Do you think that the framing of the debate has changed?
I think I know that the framing of the debate has always been important, that this is not a new issue. Way back in the early 1960s, there was an organization called the Mattachine Society, and in Washington, D.C., there was a branch of the organization that was very forward-thinking. It was led by a man named Frank Kameny, who died recently, one of the great heroes of the gay civil rights movement. Frank came up with the phrase, gay is good, patterned after black is beautiful, to help gay people feel more of a sense of pride about themselves. And one of the activists he worked with at the time accused him of trying to market gay people like a tube of toothpaste. And he said, exactly, that is exactly what I'm doing. And it was important to have the right slogans that people at protests, and he led the first protest in front of the White House in 1965, that people had to dress properly so that their messages could be heard, that the way they looked didn't get in the way of their message. So framing the issue is very important, and some people have been very astute in framing the issue. For example, Roberta Kaplan, who took on the Edie Windsor Defense of Marriage Act case, understood very clearly from the beginning that if she focused on a single client, like Edie Windsor, who was very sympathetic, elderly, widowed, having to pay crazy amounts of money for taxes that she shouldn't have had to pay if she'd been married to her partner, that was a very appealing image, a very compelling story, and people could sign on to that from across the spectrum. What Republican is going to argue that we should be paying death taxes, which was exactly the case with Edie Windsor? So framing the issue is very important. I wouldn't say there's been any particular concerted effort across the gay rights movement to reframe this, but it never hurts to point fingers. It always helps to bring people in.
We're talking right now to journalist and author Eric Marcus about what made 2013 such a great year for gay rights.
We want to hear from you on this. Do you think public opinion is changing about gay people in our culture? Did you personally change your mind on same-sex marriage or gay rights? Call in and share your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation right now about how 2013 was a big year for gay rights.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in with your thoughts. Do you think public opinion is changing on gay rights? Have you noticed a change in your community? What do you think is behind this change? Did you personally change your mind on same-sex marriage or other gay rights issues over the past few years? We'd like to hear what you have to say. Call in and share your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
And if you are gay yourself, do you sense that anything has changed? Has your feeling of acceptance changed? Do you think that this was a big year? Do you agree that this was the greatest year in gay rights? Let us know. And we pick up now with Eric Marcus, and we're talking about the big year. And Eric, you opened talking about Utah. And, you know, here we have a conservative state, headquarters of the Mormon Church, and hundreds of gay couples lining up to get married. What does that say to you about what to expect in terms of same-sex legalization of marriage going down the road?
I think what we'll see very shortly, if not in 2014, certainly soon after, that either it'll happen state by state, that marriage will be allowed between two people of the same sex, or it'll happen all at once, depending upon court rulings. One point I want to make is that this is still very much a personal issue, that the reason public opinion has shifted as much as it has is because so many individuals have chosen to share with their loved ones the truth about their lives. And I don't want to minimize how difficult that is for many, if not most, people, because of their fear of being rejected, which happens sometimes, less often than people might imagine, because parents generally love their children, even if their children aren't the people they thought they might be. So it's something that's something that needs to continue, and we've seen a wave of coming out stories in this past year of people who are well known, whether it was Brian Boitano, who just came out just the other day, or Jim Nabors, famous actor, all of us know from television and I always think of him on the Carol Burnett show. All kinds of people, whether it's politicians, local politicians, or national politicians, or people we care about, have come out in this past year, and that's part of the tidal wave that we're seeing and will continue to see. As people grow more comfortable, they'll share their personal stories with people around them, and that will change the opinions of individuals. That's what changes minds. The president helps move things along. Court rulings help move things along, but it's still the one-on-one relationship that makes all the difference, just as it was with my grandmother, who came over on a boat from Poland in 1909, who became a big champion of gay rights in her 90s and spoke at my commitment ceremony to my partner 17 years ago in just the most loving and supportive way, because she got to know me as a gay person and she got to know him and accept him as a grandson as well.
Hmm. Well, and you also have, you know, Tammy Baldwin from here in Wisconsin being sworn in as the first openly gay senator in the United States. And it didn't seem to create, you know, much of a wave at all. It was just what it was.
Yeah, and I'm struck by how in the New York Times, for example, which is the newspaper I read, stories about states permitting gay marriage or marriage equality show up on the inside of the newspaper now, not the front page. I remember when it was front page news when the chief medical examiner in New York City came out in the late 1970s. It was front page news, a local health official. And now Tammy Baldwin's election was great. It proved that you can be elected as an openly gay person to the Senate, but it was a big so what.
All right, I'm going to go to the phones now. We have Erica who's joining us from Lake Tomahawk. Hey, Erica.
Hello. I just want for one thing, I guess, Tammy Baldwin is my hero, but I'm an older transgendered person. And I don't fit certain molds. I pump septics for a living. I drive a truck. And the people I work for have asked me not to show up in a prom dress. But but other than that, it's kind of a non-issue. And I just adore this. It's also not really much of a prom dress kind of a job.
Right.
But the laws can be laws, and legislation can be that, but attitudes are the most, by far the most important.
And did you see those attitudes? Did you see those attitudes changing in 2013?
Hugely, hugely. And it's not just me putting on my big girl panties and coming out, but it has become so less of a thing with almost anybody. The people I work for are not young. And it's like, I think they would rather not have to deal with it, but they are. And they're doing a pretty good job, I think.
All right. Erica, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Eric, what do you think about that story? Is that typical to what you're seeing?
It's certainly what I'm hearing. The fact that so many people have come forward to speak honestly about their lives, including transgender people, there's a lot that isn't surprising anymore. There are still plenty of things that people struggle with. For one thing, I've talked with parents who have young children who have who they think may be transgendered when they grow older. That's an area where people still have a lot to learn, and I'm no expert on that issue. My issue is my area of expertise is concerning gay and lesbian people. But I find people in general are much more open. That isn't to say that there isn't still enormous discrimination, and we don't have a national law preventing people from being fired simply because they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered. So yes, I'm seeing more and more acceptance, but that goes both ways. It's because more and more people feel comfortable sharing the truth about their lives.
What do you think will happen in 2014 as you look forward? 2013, as we've been talking about, has been a big year for advancements in gay rights. Do you expect to see more of the same?
Well, we're not going to see this. We're not going to see DOMA overturned. It's already been overturned. I think we'll see smaller incremental changes. I don't think we'll see the Employment Non-Discrimination Act passed by the House. I don't think the House is going to do much of anything next year. They've just about won the award for the most do-nothing Congress in the history of the Congress for 2013, and I suspect that they'll get the same award for 2014. So But the fact that the Senate passed the law suggests that when the House eventually starts doing something again, that it will pass there as well. But it's also up to gay people of all stripes to continue doing the work that we do, which is to be open about our lives when we can, where we can, as long as we're in a place where we can do it in a safe way, meaning that by being out, we're not endangering our lives in any way.
We're a couple years out from a big election season. Do you think it's possible for a presidential candidate to get elected moving forward if they don't support gay rights?
No, I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible for any mainstream statewide or countrywide, nationwide official to be elected if they are anti-gay. I think it's still possible for people who run in the House. I think it's tough for people who run in the Senate to express those views. That ship has sailed. I remember all too well, as do probably most people listening, how support for or opposition to gay people and gay rights has been used in elections quite successfully, especially by conservatives in recent decades. But I think it's going to be very difficult going forward to use that issue in most places in the United States.
I wonder, thinking about, the big picture of 2013, it seemed as though an awful lot happened in a single year. Do you think that's unusual when you're talking about struggles for equality? Our country has seen several of them, including, the civil rights era.
Sure.
And they don't seem to have happened
with such speed in this manner.
It seems like it unfolded in an unusual way. Do you think that's right?
In a very dramatic and fast way. One of my friends, Linda Hirschman, wrote a book called Victory, in which she looked at the gay rights movement in comparison to the black civil rights movement, the women's movement, and how things have moved with gay rights in a way that's different from those other civil rights efforts. And I might add that many of the ideas for how to move the gay rights movement forward came out of those earlier movements. But this movement, she notes in her book, moved much faster than the other two, and explains in her book why. And I wouldn't even attempt to explain her thesis on this show. But it's different. It's different. The fact that gay people exist in virtually every family in the country makes it different. We're not the other, it turns out. We are your brothers, sisters, and fathers, and mothers, and neighbors, and colleagues. So everyone knows someone who's gay. So I think that the barrier, once it started to fall, fell more quickly. The first gay rights group in the U.S. was founded in 1950. That's only 63 years ago. So we've gone from an organization that was founded by five guys in Los Angeles in an apartment with the blinds drawn to when gay people were routinely fired from their jobs and rejected by their families, to a period now where this is a mainstream civil rights issue supported by huge numbers of people, in particular young people.
Well, Eric, we'll leave it there. And thank you so much for joining us today, and enjoy your 70-degree weather out there.
It's 59.
Oh, 59.
The temperature's dropping. It'll be 19 degrees tomorrow.
All right, good. I feel better.
Good luck digging out.
All right, thanks a lot. That was Eric Marcus, journalist and the author of Making Gay History, The Half-Century Fight for Lesbian and Gay Equal Rights.
Coming up next, we'll talk about what's next for the economy. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.